Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Top-performing teams don't come about just by visionary leadership and talented, motivated players. Standout performance is what it takes to be a top business team. In the new book, Great Business Teams, author Howard Gutman examines the inner workings of over 30 business teams at top management, business unit, and functional levels. Gutman isolates five key factors that drive up team performance and, in the process, challenges prevailing notions of team leadership, replacing them with a fresh and dynamic approach to achieving better results. Howard, welcome to the program. What prompted you to write about great business teams?
Over the years, we work with presidents and senior teams of major companies, J&J, Novartis, Mars, Pfizer, etc. After a while, it became very clear that regardless of industry setting, there were certain consistencies, almost like a DNA pattern, that we were able to really track. So in our mind, we felt it would be compelling for people to really get a sense of what were the distinctions that really made or broke a senior team's ability to really work at a high-performing level. So in the end, we interviewed about 38 executives representing about 25 different companies to really get that picture.
Based upon your research, what makes a great business team stand apart?
First, when we talk about a great business team, we're talking about a team that not only achieves business results, which would be a given, Dave, but secondly, a team that has the capacity to really create a sustainable organization, an enduring organization. So there are two factors. But the five ultimate characteristics that came up were really these. And each one, obviously, you can get into a lot of depth. But essentially, one is that you have a leader who gets how to run a high-performance team. Secondly, you have players in the team that are much more we-directed, us-directed. Third, there are explicit ground rules or protocols that are transparent on how the team needs to operate. Fourth, they are constantly raising the performance bar, not just on business results, but also the team's ability to get to a high-performing state that can be measured. And finally, the last, that there's a performance management system that really is team-based, so the people have some skin in the game. Those really were the five things that tended to make these great business teams track, regardless of industry.
Tell me a little bit about the leaders of these great business teams. What's the biggest transformation a leader must make to become a great leader?
If you ask the leaders, which obviously we did, what was one of the greatest challenges for most of them, they would say it was the ability to model a willingness to hear feedback and not be defensive. They saw that as really one of the greatest hurdles for them. And that is one of the skills. Other skills are their ability to be candid, their ability to be authentic in the moment, hold up a mirror to the players. Another one would be the ability to actually facilitate the team's interaction. And then finally, another would be their ability to actually coach the players. So again, it would be the ability to be authentic, candor. Second, to be receptive, depersonalized feedback. Third, to facilitate the team. And fourth, coach the players. Those are really the big four.
What are the skills of the team itself? What makes for a great team?
To me, the big rite of passage is their willingness to shift their notion of what does it mean to be accountable. So let me just drill into that. I think it's an interesting point. The first level of accountability is when you take accountability for yourself, for your own job, which is a good thing. The second level is you take accountability for the people that report to you. The third level that we're talking about is the level where you're taking accountability for your peers' success. The fourth level is you take accountability for the leader. And finally, the fifth is you take accountability for the enterprise. So we're talking about getting to the point where everybody on that team, it's a given that they take accountability for their own job, but it's really around, are they at stake for the success of their colleagues and the leader and the enterprise? And can they actually play that out behaviorally? That usually is something that's very counterintuitive for most people coming in. Because for any of us coming into a job, our normal focus is doing our job. The idea that somehow we're accountable for the other people is not something that is immediately evident to people.
I was very interested in many of the stories you tell in the book. Can you share with us a bit of the Mars Company story?
The Mars one is really an interesting one because this actually is one of the first books, the only one that I'm aware of, that a lot of the Mars story is actually out in print. Mars, as many people know, is a private company, and it's about $24 billion, although now with the acquisition of Wrigley, it's even more than that. But anyway, it had been a very successful company for about 100 years, very familial organization. Professional management at the turn of this century recognized that growth was very slow. You had an old company that was set up in silos, and it was not possible to really get the type of business growth that they wanted. So the new leader coming in, a guy by the name of Paul Michaels, who's actually ex-Johnson & Johnson, deemed it necessary to really create a horizontal organization. In other words, as opposed to working as a hub and spoke with little silos or fiefdoms, the goal here was to really set up this high performance or horizontal way of working, where there was peer accountability versus everything was centered around him. Consequently, over the years, we have done alignments of the senior team at Mars, of US, Europe, Asia Pac, etc. And we've been able to really help them create outstanding business results over the years.
You've talked about alignment, so let's discuss that.
When you think of the term alignment, you think of aligning your back, going to a chiropractor, or aligning the wheels of your car. From a business standpoint, there's really five factors that signify an aligned business or a congruent business. The first factor at the top would be that people are aligned on strategy. The second is they can translate that into business deliverables. The third, they're aligned in terms of accountabilities, who's doing what to whom. Fourth, they have explicit protocols, meaning when decisions are made, when are they unilateral, when are they consultative, when are they consensus, when conflicts emerge, how do they escalate, how do they force closure. And then finally, the last is they're aligned regarding the business relationships, which really is the issue of interdependencies. When do I work independently or interdependently? So netting it out, when you look at dysfunctions that occur in business, they're usually symptoms of one or more of these alignment factors not being in sync. So in other words, for anyone listening to this, they can think about their own job. If you and I do not agree on our goals, we're going to inadvertently be competing for our resources. If we don't agree on accountabilities, I'm going to have an expectation of you or vice versa, which won't be fulfilled. If we don't have agreement on protocols, rules of engagement, people make them up. And as people go from company to company, they just bring whatever practices they want. Finally, if we don't agree on interdependencies, people instinctively kind of hunker down in their own silo. So alignment, when we work at a Johnson & Johnson or a Chico's, even though it's apples and oranges in terms of industries, the fact still is that those five alignment factors underlie any business, a school system, a library, it doesn't really matter. When people say, well, our business is different, they're right. The culture is different. The business model may be different. The people are different. But underneath, it's still just like an automobile. It is what it is. And those five factors have to be in sync.
And what's the biggest challenge leaders face in moving themselves and their organizations to the next level of play, the kind of play that you've been talking about?
Going back to what I said before around being counterintuitive, when you go into an organization and start to assess it in terms of its readiness, generally speaking, you find three types of individuals. You find the people who operate like players, who are the ones who really challenge the status quo, take the risks, try to move it forward. That's about 20%. Then you've got the broad swath in the middle, 50%, which are like the vacationers. They don't want to have a hassle. They want to do their job, go home. The last thing they want to do is have more stress. Then you finally have a group called the prisoners, the unhappy vacationers. These are the angry people that quit and stay. The toughest thing for a leader to do is to enroll people, literally enroll people to follow them. The old adage around leadership, which is a great line, is that you're not a leader until people choose to literally follow you. So to me, the biggest challenge that a leader has is to create a compelling vision and then be able to enroll folks to want to follow them, particularly in something like this, which can be daunting because as opposed to someone just getting paid to do their own job, now what the leader's asking them to do is take an enterprise level of accountability. That's a much bigger ask than what most people are used to.
Could you give an example of what a protocol is and how it affects a team?
Protocols are rules of engagement, ways to work. If you think of something like conflict resolution, a protocol might be that, let's say, there is no triangulation allowed. In other words, if I had an issue with you, Dave, as opposed to going over to Bill and me complaining to Bill about you, I go directly to you. Another protocol might be that within 48 hours, literally, if someone has an issue with anyone else on the team, they have to convey that there's an issue and a conversation that needs to ensue within the 48-hour time period versus you hear about it 3 weeks later, a month later. Those would be an example of two protocols. Another one might be you cannot deal with conflicts through email. It needs to be face-to-face or at least by phone, but email is verboten. So protocols really are explicit rules of engagement that people really are held accountable for.
There's a whole section in your book on how it's possible to create great teams and from great teams, create great organizations. That's what happened at Mars, right?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
When you're aligning a senior team, if you think of it almost like a linear progression, even though life doesn't necessarily work linearly, this is what it would look like. You do an overview initially, maybe about 90 minutes, and you convey to the senior team where they want to go. The leader will convey, here's the objective. The consultant will explain the process. Then we interview the players, and then we bring the senior team together. Then we'll reassess them 3 to 5 months down the line. Maybe we'll coach the players in between. We'll provide them with skill sets. At some point, when traction is being attained, and when I say traction, I'm saying explicitly in terms of the data we collect, benchmarking the team as a high-performing team. Once the data starts moving to the right side of the Likert scale, where there's some evidence they're moving well, you do an overview for the next level. And then what you ultimately do is bring the next level in. So for an example, 2 months ago in Barcelona, we were with the senior team in the next level for Novartis Consumer, 140 people. Over 2 days, we basically aligned level to level within function and cross-function. That's when you start to move the game. Because ultimately, the belief, at least our belief, is that in an organization, you have to have the hearts and minds of the senior team in the next level. That's what makes or breaks you. It doesn't matter if there are thousands of people in the company. It's usually going to be that 50 to 150 people, based on how flat the organization is, which really is got to be the model of what high performance is in the organization. And if you don't have them, you can't go anywhere in that company.
So that's how great business teams crack the code for standout performance. It's a really fascinating book, Howard. I want to thank you for being here. We've had Howard M. Gutman, author of Great Business Teams, Cracking the Code for Standout Performance. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it.
Now it's time for You've Been Spotted, where we interview people at one of our centers. For more information on our centers and our seminars, please visit our website at amanet.org.
Hi, this is Kevin Lee, and I'm visiting AMA's seminar, Preparing for Leadership, What It Takes to Take the Lead.
I'm Ruth Nelson. I am one of the course leaders for Preparing for Leadership. Leadership is all about influencing and inspiring others, and anyone at any time could take on a leadership role. When we're talking about team building, that's what leaders do. You cannot have an effective team, for example, if there's no trust. We talk about how we build trust. You won't have an effective team unless people are motivated. We talk about how, as a leader, you can motivate others.
In my current role, I have a lot of indirect responsibilities for leadership and power, but looking to develop that into a more formal position that would allow me to have more leadership responsibilities. Currently, we're working on an exercise that's talking about utilizing influence and power and politics all together. We're presented with a task with some challenges in terms of personnel, manpower, and a deadline that's very short. So we need to work with another manager to acquire one of their team members to work on our project.
I'm senior to manage our new product planning for our oncology division. I could say that the one key takeaway is sometimes you don't realize how important trust is and being open and honest in communication. And a class really helped me to understand how it's important to have open and honest communication. You may not realize it, that somebody else might perceive you as holding something back and might not trust you and your leadership abilities, so how that's very important.
It would be great to hear your feedback on this program, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.